Today's episode is supported by Theranordic, a next-generation gut health company. They're doing amazing work with incredible molecules that support your gut integrity and function. I'll give you all the details later in the show. 44% of us have a gene mutation that stops our body from performing optimally, depriving it of essential nutrients.
The association of this one gene mutation to such a wide myriad of seemingly unrelated consequences in the body is astounding.
Anxiety, depression, ADHD, gut issues, whatever it is, today's guest can tell you exactly what raw material is missing from your body that causes this problem.
The majority of pathology and disease as we know it today could be traced back to nutrient deficiencies. By putting the raw material back into the human body, you can get it to perform the way it was designed.
Gary Brecker is obsessed with his goal of becoming the ultimate human and helping you get there too.
We are microdosing ourselves to death. The Superhuman Protocol is my favorite biohack, and I'll tell you how you can do it for $120,000, and I'll tell you how you can do it for free.
Welcome to the Health Optimization Podcast. I'm Tim Gray, the UK's leading biohacker. This podcast is all about gaining actionable advice from the world's top experts and sharing new breakthroughs in nature, biohacking, technology, and longevity research to help you live longer and happier. Everything I cover on this podcast are the things I've learned from the world's top medical professionals, researchers, scientists, and authors in the health field. However, I'm none of those things. I'm just someone with a very keen mind for figuring out how to be as healthy as possible while aging gracefully and learning from the best. My only bias is health. Peak functionality lies in your genes. Most of us are operating at just 55% of our true state of normal. But the most common issues we're facing, from anxiety to brain fog, aren't caused by external factors. There's something wrong in our physiology. Many of us lack the ability to properly methylate, and we'll explain in a bit why methylation is the key factor that decides whether or not we're healthy. But what do we do about it? Gary Brecker says the secret lies in our genes, that improving our genetic function is the key to living a longer, fuller life. Gary is a leading biohacker, professional human biologist, podcast host, the co-founder of 10X Health, and the founder of The Ultimate Human. He's on a mission to uncover the safest and fastest way to optimize your mind, body, and spirit through modern science. He's worked with some of the best professional athletes, CEOs, and celebrities in the world, including Dana White and Grant Cardone.
Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So you started out as a mortality expert for insurance. Mm-hmm. And how did you get from that into a career of health and biohacking?
You know, probably of all the things that I get flack about, I get the most flack about my past career as a mortality expert, because people will say, oh, if you guys could predict mortality to the month, you know, you would have won a Nobel Prize. You would have, you'd be Jesus. And I can see how people are very suspect of the science of mortality, but it's some of the most accurate science in the world. I mean, if you look at the amount of the tens of billions of dollars every year in financial services products that are based on mortality, right? Life insurance, reverse mortgages, annuities. These are some of the biggest financial services products in the world. And they're based on one variable, right? How many more months does somebody have left on Earth? And we all know that we're on an actuarial curve, right? I mean, if you're a 34-year-old male, you have a life expectancy of X. If you're a 25-year-old female, you have a life expectancy of Y. If you're 81 years old, you have a life expectancy of this. But when a financial institution like a large life insurance company is getting ready to put significant risk on your life, $25 million, $50 million worth of risk on your life, they really don't care where you are on an actuarial curve. They want to know your specific mortality. And the one thing that they have that no collegiate university, no medical system, no research study, not even the federal government has, is they know the day, the date, the time, the location, and the cause of death for millions and millions of lives. So they have data, and they are a data-driven business. And if you want to know how accurately they predict mortality, just look at what happened in the United States in the 2008-2009 financial services crisis. We had 364 banks fail. We didn't have a single life insurance company fail. It is extraordinarily accurate data. And what they do is they look at the entire person, right? I mean, what is the effect of statin therapy long-term? Does it have an impact on all-cause mortality? Do statins reduce the production of hormones, cell walls, cell membranes, reduce vitamin D3? And then what is the impact of that? And how does that accelerate disease and pathology and maybe even result in early death? What about corticosteroids, thyroid medications, antidepressants? So they know the trajectory of pharmaceuticals, synthetics, chemicals, of certain lifestyle habits, which is why demographic data is incorporated into these predictions. But for me, I always thought of my career for many, many years as just a data career. I was fascinated by the data. And I began to slowly realize that there were human beings on the other side of these spreadsheets, right? It wasn't just data. Mm. And not only that, but I began to realize that, and so did the teams that I was associated with, we began to realize that the majority of the reason why people are not living healthier, happier, longer lives, including yourself when you started your own journey, right, were because of what we called modifiable risk factors. So had I, at a very long point in my career, been able to pick up the phone and just contact that client, mm-hmm. that applicant, I could have made a dramatic change in their life. Now, I was legally prohibited from doing so, and rightfully so. I'm not a doctor. I'm not licensed to practice medicine. I was there to do a mortality prediction, but I could see things going wrong in the medical record. I could see the trajectory of somebody's life that had just simple clinical deficiencies like vitamin D3, like untreated anemia, like hormone imbalance, that were just robbing them of their livelihood. Because in somebody's medical record is not just their red blood cell count and their sugar level and their hormone level. What's in their medical record is their history. Like when they go in and speak to a doctor, a lot of that conversational history is in their medical record. You know, they would talk about the loss of a loved one and this is the reason they were depressed. And so you would actually get this interesting picture of who the person was. Like I felt like I actually really knew some of these people that I'd never met because I had a window into their life that I didn't even have into some of my closest family members. Mm. I mean, I knew their blood work, their demographic data. I saw all of their trusts, their bank accounts, their brokerage accounts. I knew that they were treating their children differently in their will. I saw their divorce decrees. So a lot of, you know, very sensitive information. And I realized that I wasn't doing anything in service of humanity. There was a very specific case that really affected me. It was a woman in the Midwest who was transferring care to another cardiologist, was about to start taking a contraindicated script. And I realized that had I been able to contact her, could have potentially saved her from having a thrombolytic event, you know, a stroke, a blood clot, an embolism. So I made a conscious decision to resign from that career and spend the balance of my lifetime doing what I could to help people live healthier, happier, longer lives. And I brought with me a lot of data.
Crazy. It's an interesting journey because obviously biohacking, a good part of what quantifies is the data. I mean, what you don't measure, you can't manage. And yet that is big, 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 big health data. And it's a shame that governments don't use that because then, you know, pharmaceuticals would be used more appropriately knowing the predictive route opposed to a subjective opinion by one physician or something like that.
And we actually ignore a lot of big data. Mm. You know, we'll get pigeonholed into a philosophy. I mean, some of the worst science, in my opinion, that is done on human beings is where we study things in isolation, right? Because human beings exist in communities. Cells exist in communities. When you take them out of the communal environment that they live in and you study them in vitro in a petri dish and you say, under this circumstance, it behaves this way, and you look at it very myopically, and you say, well, if I give this drug for this purpose, in other words, LDL cholesterol high, let's bring LDL cholesterol low. That has an effect on this type of cardiovascular disease. But what else did what were the other spokes of the wheel that affected? I mean, and I'm not saying this specifically about that drug, but I mean, did the reduction in LDL cholesterol result in poor cell membrane formation, poor hormone production, and poor production of vitamin D3, cholecalciferol? And what consequences did that have down the road? And were those consequences potentially more detrimental than the problem you're trying to fix?
Yeah.
right? Sort of like getting a flat tire and then saying, all right, well, I'm going to slash my other three tires. So at least everything's equal, right? Mm-hmm. So I create balance and equilibrium. It doesn't really make sense. And I saw a lot of that in how human beings were being treated, not really addressed as a...
The data piece is obviously a solid foundation within biohacking, but how do you think you differ from the other biohackers?
Well, I might differ from the other biohackers. First of all, I'm a human biologist, so my undergraduate degrees are in biology. And then I have another four-year degree in human biology. I actually went to chiropractic college. I never practiced chiropractic. I didn't go on to clinicals and get my license. But I spent another 4 years studying human biology. And I think maybe where I differ is that I didn't really get my knowledge, although I got my basic fundamental understanding of human beings from school. I got the knowledge that I spend my time espousing from big data, from 20 years of looking at big data and what actually truly does impact mortality. And so very often I will say things that are against the conventional grain, and people will say there's no evidence for that. There's no randomized clinical trial to prove that. But there are lots of things that we don't need randomized clinical trials to prove. I mean, there's never been a randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial on parachutes, but I don't think anybody would jump out of an airplane without one.
I often say this about banging your head against the wall. Like, there's no clinical trials to prove that banging your head against the wall won't hurt you.
Right.
It doesn't mean that it won't hurt you.
Yeah. I think we need less people to just recite the conclusion section of clinical data than we do to assemble pools of information and try to give reasonable suggestions on what people can do to change the trajectory of their life based on large pools of data. So I think, you know, therein lies the area where I may differ with some biohackers.
Nicely said, nicely said. But I think one thing that strikes me from what we've talked, obviously, offline is that, you know, you talk about the things that work that you use yourself, which is something that I hold dear to myself, because it's too easy to jump on the promotion and the affiliate route and just promote everything to get more money, opposed to the goal of actually helping people. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I think for me that I identify with and I really respect.
Yeah, thank you.
But it is a tough thing to keep out of, especially when people are throwing money at you left, right, and center.
But that's when it is.
I think the integrity piece comes across quite nicely. And I think so, as a human biologist, which a lot of the biohackers aren't, they're self-experimenters and, let's say, N equals one data guys. Mm-hmm. What do you think other biohackers or the biohacking space, to put it more broadly, have got wrong to this date, or something that you think is just batshit crazy?
I don't know that they've gotten it wrong. I have a lot of folks out there I would consider adversaries, right? I'm not adversarial towards them. They're very adversarial towards me, but I actually learn a lot from them. They help to keep me sharp. You know, you can watch a 3-hour podcast and find the one gotcha moment where, he said sodium chloride, not sodium hydroxide. He's a fraud. You know, he's a liar. So I try not to let that bother me, but I also try to remind myself that I do have an obligation to be more precise. And you know, I'm disappointed in myself sometimes when I read articles and I get excited and then I get out there and I espouse it in the public domain. And I have to remember that I have a large platform and, you know, sometimes tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of views. And I have a responsibility to be a lot more accurate and to really have a better fundamental understanding before I just get excited about a topic and put it out there. And I get reminded of that every time that happens. But at the end of the day, I think that we are all hopefully in service of humanity. Like, I hope that, you know, we have the philosophy that the information doesn't belong to us. We're blessed enough to have it flow through us. And no one person is either all bad or all good. And when you catch somebody then, you know, making a mistake, or they misquoted a scientific study, then it doesn't mean that everything they've said and everything they've done in their entire life is just a complete waste. There's still a massively positive impact that they're making in the world. And I try to look for that in the other biohackers and say, you know, what can I learn from them? And, you know, the majority of where I see things potentially going wrong are when people adopt a very narrow philosophical belief and they dogmatically defend that belief and refuse to give it up regardless of where the data takes them. And I think a true scientist, a true quote unquote biohacker, should be willing to have their mind changed. They should be willing to say, you know what, I was actually wrong about this. Now that I really look at the data, I was wrong about this. And I think that we all should look to take the collective of data and try to draw conclusions from that and give humanity an opportunity to consider the things in totality. Like, for example, I talked about how, you know, I believe that cold water immersion is a great way to burn fat. There are no randomized clinical trials specifically looking at cold water immersion and its impact on visceral fat reduction or, you know, fatty acid metabolism. But when you look at the collective of the data, it's like, well, it activates brown fat. Brown fat is our thermogenic source, which exchanges a calorie for heat, right? So there's a caloric expenditure, there's a cost. There are studies that have actually looked at how it has a positive impact on insulin resistance, hemoglobin A1C, blood sugar. We know that insulin resistance is one of the leading causes of people getting obesity and having a very difficult time losing weight in a hyperinsulinemic environment. We know that it increases our metabolism. It causes peripheral vasoconstriction, all of these things. So you could put that data together and say, this is a good way, all things else considered equal. You know, you don't increase your caloric intake during the day. Cold water immersion could help you lose weight. Cold water immersion could help you lose fat. Why? Because there are enough data points that we can connect to say that cold water immersion, and sometimes I'll get called out for saying, but there's no randomized, you know, clinical trial specifically studying that. Yeah, but when you reduce insulin and you activate brown fat and you have a caloric expenditure and you have a thermogenic process in the body and you have a positive impact on metabolism, all of those things cause weight reduction and they cause fatty acid metabolism. They cause you to lose fat.
The funny thing is what you just said there, and in my head, it's actually awesome that you said that, was because if you have one opinion and I have an opposing opinion, if I'd been where you were when you heard what you heard to give you that opinion and you had been where I was, mm-hmm. surely we'd have the opposite opinion. So it's possible to have the flip 180 opinion depending on where you were and where you got that.
Right.
You
know.
And so there's a line actually in my monthly reminders that every month I have like 50 quotes that I read through to remind me and to keep me on track. Mm. And one of them is, I don't form an opinion until I can verify the opposing opinion of my own opinion so that my challenges aren't challenges. I can speak from a place of knowledge. Mm. And I think I have changed my mind on several things before, like, actually, this is absolutely amazing, and changed my opinion. And
right.
I think the problem is that the definition of pseudoscience is to work towards your already opinion and to prove it,
right,
opposed to where does it lead me?
The whole thing about science is it's supposed to be based on a hypothesis, which is the postulated question, not the outcome. So you're supposed to pose the question and then allow the data to answer the question. But so many of us form a hypothesis with a preconceived notion that this is the destination I want to get to. And so we find ourselves saying, this is the only diet that works. This is the only supplement that you need. And this is the number one thing that, you know, you need to do to change your life. And nothing about the communal way that cells behave and humans behave is that singular. And so I think we need more people interpreting pools of data than we do reciting the conclusion section of published peer-reviewed clinical literature, because and this is how science has led us around, down some very detrimental rabbit holes. And I'll give you plenty of examples. I mean, when in the mortality space, we knew from data, and I can defend this, we knew because of large data that one of the underlying causes of accelerated disease pathology, decreased health span and decreased lifespan, was something we called a hypoxic curve, how well the body was managing oxygen. So, and it's not as simple as just breathing more, right? So how well did the body manage oxygen? Well, you look at a blood or somebody's blood work. And the first section is usually something called the CBC, the complete blood count. And in this complete blood count, you look at red blood cells, you look at hemoglobin, you look at something called hematocrit, blood viscosity. But we knew that even though there was a range of normal, that as you decreased the number of red blood cells in the normal range and decreased the amount of hemoglobin in the normal range, you had reduced oxygen transport. As you had reduced oxygen transport, you would see the exacerbation of things like basic daily nagging things like brain fog, weight gain, water retention, poor delta wave of sleep. You need a high oxidative state to get into a deep sleep because our respiratory rate is low. So you would have these normal conditions that were dramatically impacting people's lifestyle and their quality of life. And then when we looked at, okay, what is driving this poor level of oxygen transport? Well, in the majority of the cases, the data said was low hormones. And the main hormone that was low was the hormone testosterone. And then we started to look at, well, what are some of the roles of the hormone testosterone? You know, I always thought it was a male hormone responsible for facial hair and body, you know, and muscles and aggression and deep voice and all of that. And you realize that, well, testosterone has a massive impact on erythropoiesis, the production of red blood cells. And why was testosterone low in so many deficient middle-aged men and women? Well, because they were low on certain nutrients like DHEA and D3. And this started to lead me down this road of, wow, nutrient deficiencies are actually causing some catastrophic issues in people's lives. And these nutrient deficiencies are easy to fix. We would see, you know, adjust the D3 into the optimal range, adjust the DHEA into the optimal range. It raised the person's hormone level, which improved the production of red blood cells and hemoglobin, which increased the amount of oxygen in the blood, which led to them reporting that they had no more brain fog, that they slept better, that they actually were able to lose weight, that their libido returned. And so, like I say, you look at the communal way that we process data, and then you can extrapolate from that and say, well, one of the suggestions I would make to you, if you want more energy and less brain fog and deeper sleep and a greater libido, is go get these things checked. Look at your D3, look at your DHEA. Before you do a hormone replacement, look at some of the raw materials the body uses to build those structures and see if by putting the raw material back into the human body, you can get it to perform the way it was designed.
It seems super interesting. I mean, it's like, but there's no double-blind studies on that exactly.
double-blind placebo-controlled, randomized trials on that. So you just get blasted for it. And I'm like, well, what is the downside of putting your, and I'm not saying just randomly shovel D3 in and randomly shovel DHEA in or just randomly take sodium. I'm saying get data, right? Get some blood work done and say, wow, I am in the bottom third of this range, and I have virtually no DHEA, and I have virtually no vitamin D3. You know, I would argue that D3 is the single most important nutrient in the human body. So it's actually the only vitamin that human beings make on our own. I'm not aware of a single cell in the entire body that doesn't have a receptor site for that vitamin. So if you just logically put this together and you believe in God like I do, he made us with the ability to make one vitamin, one. When he created man, I mean, we only need sunlight and cholesterol to make vitamin D3. It's probably pretty important. Mm. So why don't we put this in the optimal range? And why don't we put DHEA in the optimal range and see if that has an impact on our hormone level?
It's really funny you say about optimal range, because this is something that always makes me laugh when I have some bloods read by someone else. And there's people that are obviously significantly better than me at it. But when I go to, let's say, a medical professional, they're like, you're on the lower side, but it's in the optimal range. Oh, you're on the higher, but you're in the optimal range. And it's like, I always think, oh, if you've got one thing lower and one thing higher, but they're both in the optimal range, it's like saying you've got, you know, a 7 foot, 3 pound human. It's like, yeah. but you know, seven foot, three pounds. You know, you could have a 7 foot human, and you could, you know,
right,
depending on the age, a 3 pound or a 100 pound, mm-hmm, but they don't go together. And yet on paper, when you're talking about thyroid hormones or deficiencies,
right,
it's like, actually, no, this is in range. All good. It's like, right, but what happens if we get those nearer to where they should be? Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you've actually got someone that looks like a human that is correct, like, or operates like a human?
And I would totally agree with that. I mean, we you know, like I said, we knew in the mortality space, for example, that if you wanted to cut a human being's life expectancy in half, and I mean at any age, male or female, if you want to cut their life expectancy by 50%, put them in isolation. Why then do we study cellular structures in the body in complete isolation? You know, when we take a cell or tissue out of the body, we put it in a petri dish and we study how it behaves in a laboratory in vitro, but not in the community in which it exists. This is where we get some very detrimental science, in my opinion. And it's placebo controlled and it's double blind and it's randomized. And then those trials are used to bring some of the multi-billion dollar medications to market. And we've actually looked very narrowly at one small sliver of human physiology and the effect that one chemical or one synthetic or one pharmaceutical has on this single compound. And we assume that by having that one single effect, that we're not interfering with the community. So it's my message is why don't we actually look at what the raw material is that the human body needs to do its job? You know, in the podcast that I had with you previously, you know, you talked about how you were urinating 30, 40, 50 times a day, and you found out you had a potassium deficiency. So you actually didn't have a urinary frequency disorder. You actually had a potassium deficiency. And I would argue that the majority of pathology and disease as we know it today could be traced back to nutrient deficiencies. We are so nutrient deficient. There's very little risk, in my opinion, of starting with nutrifying the body, right? We need 91 essential minerals. Most of us are deficient in several of those. We need 3 essential fatty acids. Most of us have far in excess of the fatty acids we don't need, which is seed oils, what have you. And we are clinically deficient in the ones that we need. And we need 8 essential amino acids. And amino acids are not proteins. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. We tend to think of amino acids as something that athletes need to build strong muscles, which is true. But amino acids form the component of all of our blood, our brain, our connective tissue, every cell in the body. Every single cell contains amino acids. They also form the immune system. The part of the strength of the immune system is based on our amino acid balance. So why wouldn't we just start there, right? It's very difficult to hurt somebody by making sure that they have adequate essential aminos, adequate essential fatty acids, and adequate 91 essential.
So it's super interesting because I've often thought and said, so what's in the cell determines how the cell operates. And that could be, is there a toxicity in the cell, or mm-hmm. is there a deficiency in the cell? It's like, it's about getting the nasties out while getting the good in. And then it's basic operating machine when it's operating as such.
Yeah.
So it's actually funny that we don't look at supporting those methods. So it's really interesting to hear you say this because the data is saying this and you're talking about the main groups of things that you should have in the cell, mm-hmm. which is really interesting to hear you say it like that. Cause I haven't.
Saw this thousands and thousands of times. Understand that I got almost all of my education from reading medical records. That was my job. That was my career for 20 years. I would take a medical record on a patient. I didn't have patients, I had clients. I would take a medical record. I wasn't allowed to have any contact with that person, but I would decipher the medical record and I would pull certain things out of the medical record to put them into this model called a mortality model. And then that model would go on to predict in a pool of 1,000 lives what kind of risk that they have for mortality and by what month. And then insurance companies would put multi-million dollar financial wagers on those outcomes. And again, what I continued to realize was some of the idiocracy that I would see is you know, people would have basic issues going on, anemia. Let's just pick one. You know, they would be anemic, and once you're anemic, you know, your energy level crashes. The body doesn't have the oxidative state to perform a lot of normopathic functions. You're tired all the time. You're fatigued. You stop working out. It reduces your mobility, what we call your ambulatory profile. And the classic treatment for anemia is iron, folic acid, B12. And so, physician in with all the good intentions in the world, be like, you need to take this iron, you need to take B12, you need to take folic acid. But they would give them a form of B12 called cyanocobalamin, which a lot of people have difficult time processing. They would give them a basic iron, which would upset their stomach and make them constipated. And they would give them folic acid, which 44% of the population can't even convert into the active form called methylfolate. And it wouldn't work for years but you would still see them continuing this traditional path. Whereas if we actually got back to the basics and we said, okay, well, folic acid doesn't exist in nature. Methylfolate does. Let's give them that version. Let's give them something like an iron bisglycinate, and let's give them a naturopathic form of B12, hydroxycobalamin, adenosylcobalamin, methylcobalamin, bang, the anemia would fix. Once you fix the anemia, it was like fixing the hub of a wheel with all of these spokes. Then all of a sudden, the next time they'd see their doctor, they're like, oh my gosh, doc, my brain fog's gone. I'm horny as the devil. You know, I'm sleeping better. I'm exercising again. Yeah. You know, I'm chasing around my wife like a high schooler. And this would be in the medical record. And it really sparked my interest. I'm like, gosh, we could help humanity so much by just getting back to the basics. You know, we have something that we use in our clinic's called the Superhuman Protocol. And I get a lot of flack for this because it's a very expensive protocol. And I keep remind people that you don't need to spend a lot of money to be a superhuman. You just need to get back in touch with the basics of nature, magnetism, oxygen, light, touch the surface of the earth, which I know you're a big fan of, breath work, exposing your skin to sunlight, which I did this morning on my balcony, adding sea salt to your drinking water. My preference is a Baja gold sea salt or a Celtic salt to your drinking water. People don't want it to be that simple, but it is.
It's not sexy. That's the problem.
It's not sexy.
It's brilliant that you said that, because my next question, I was just looking down at my
structure. You're getting questions?
And
what do we got?
My next question was, tell us about the Superhuman Protocol and the key components, magnetism, oxygen, and the light. And then just as I'm about to say it, you said it.
I'm also reading minds. I not only can predict when you're going to die,
I can read your When your gut acts up, you want a solution that works and works right now. Theranordic developed Rescue, a unique blend of patented zinc, L-carnosine, and pharmaceutical-grade L-glutamine. Zinc L-carnosine is a special molecule that has been shown to adhere to inflamed sites in the gut, and it stays there for hours at a time. L-glutamine is a building material for new gut cells and boosts immune cell activity. Theranordic initially designed Rescue to calm ulcers, but customer feedback showed that it also helped with issues like heartburn, IBS, and colitis. And Rescue isn't a pill. It's a drink that soothes and heals your whole GI tract from your mouth to your esophagus to your stomach and then to your small and large intestine. This innovative solution that treats leaky gut and prevents acid reflux and heartburn is backed by real science and clinical human trials. Check out theranordic.com/timbiohacker. You get 20% off your first purchase. That's theranordic.com/timbiohacker. Remember, if you want to learn how to take control of your health and you're sick of traditional healthcare and temporary fixes, you should come to the Health Optimization Summit. You can join other like-minded enthusiasts and meet the world's leading minds in health, wellness, and science. You can even test out a load of groundbreaking health tech and latest supplements. Get your tickets at healthoptimization.com.
At this point, it's probably great if you could let us know what the foundation of like 10X Health and the Ultimate Human actually is.
Yeah. So the Ultimate Human is a podcast brand, and it's a chemical free living brand. You know, I have a dream one day of having a massive chemical free living brand, because I think we are microdosing ourselves to death. Right. And, there's a pervasive wisdom out there that the dosage determines the poison. I don't believe that. I believe that the cumulative dosage determines the poison. I think there is a lot of evidence to suggest that we are microdosing ourselves with poisons.
I love that you said that, by the way. Yeah. I absolutely love that you said that, because so many people say the dose determines the poison. Yeah, but the devil is in the detail. It's like if you understand compound theory, then...
If the dosage determined the poison, then nobody would have problems with safe levels. There are FDA, CDC safe levels of mercury. There are safe levels of arsenic. There are safe levels of cyanocobalamin. There are safe levels of all kinds of heavy metals. There are safe levels of glyphosates. So I think it's nonsensical to think that we can repeatedly assault the body with microdoses of safe poisons and have no consequences. I don't know anybody that got mercury poisoning from a single piece of tuna fish, right? So it was the repeated ingestion of mercury-laden tuna fish. So what's the solution to that? Well, try to get wild-caught fish and not so much farm-raised fish, because farm-raised fish have a tendency to swim around in their own feces, which is where the metals are excreted, and the gills will bring that back into the meat. That's not fear-mongering. These are just choices that we can make to help navigate this maze of a poison in our environment that's constantly bombarding ourselves. I mean, we have two choices. We can either filter things before they get to the temple, or we can let the temple be the filter. And unfortunately, too many of us are relying on the temple to be the filter, right? So we drink tap water and you know, it's got chlorine, it's got fluoride, it probably has some microplastics, some pharmaceuticals. It will filter out, but your body will do that filtration process. And if we just took a little extra step to maybe RO filter our water and add minerals to it and then put it in, just imagine how much we've upstaged the body's ability to now not have to focus on those microtoxins. It can focus on other microtoxins. So it's not about fear mongering. You know, oatmeal is going to kill you and eggs are going to kill you and, you know, breathing is going to kill you. And there's aluminum in the air. It's not about walking around in fear. It's about, in my opinion, getting back to the basics. In most cases too, it's not the food. It's the distance from the food to the table. You know, I can tell you from 22 years of mortality research, I didn't see a specific diet that pervasively worked for anyone to extend life. What I saw were whole food diets that seemed to be the largest extension of life. And now that I've actually gotten to know Dr. Valter Longo, who's probably the world's authority on fasting, time-restricted feeding, fast mimicking diets and his research, his book, The Longevity Diet. You know, you could take any dogmatic diet program and say, okay, what about veganism or raw food vegan? Well, if you're a vegan and all you eat is white flour, white rice, white bread, white pasta, white potatoes, and beer, you're still vegan. But now, does that mean vegan diets are bad? Absolutely not. Whole food vegan diets are amazing for you. Whole food carnivore diets are amazing for you. Whole food paleo diets are amazing for you. I believe that a whole food diet is the way to make certain that you get all the vital minerals and nutrients and live a long life, not a very highly restrictive specific diet.
And it's very individualized as well, isn't it? And I think this is, you know, actually one of the points I wanted to discuss when we recorded together for your mm-hmm. podcast, like the future trends of health. And I think personalized supplementation, like based on blood work and deficiencies.
Hugely important.
And it's the same with diets. Like, for instance, whenever I share out something saying about how including meat, and I'm not carnivore, I tried carnivore and I tried veganism.
But I'm a huge fan of carnivore. I mean, I eat a lot of meat. I mean, but
people still push back and say, no, it's, you know, it doesn't work for me. It doesn't. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't work for you. Mm-hmm. It might work for someone else. And does that mean that they
so true.
End up in a hole, can't have any energy because they can't process the vegetables like you can? Like, that's a very selfish approach to think that one size fits all mm-hmm. versus some meat or some plants, depending on where you sit in between. So it's really nice to hear. Again, I feel like we're super aligned on so many different points, slightly different angle of the same thing, that, you know, hyper individualized. And I think this is a trend of where things will be going.
Yes. One thing that I do think we need to hyper individualize. I mean, I think one of the biggest mistakes in all of modern medicine is that what goes into your body goes into my body, goes into somebody else's body, or anybody listening to this podcast body, is that it's treated all exactly the same way, right? Like, my initial issue, I don't want to go down the vaccine pathway, but my initial issue with vaccines, for example, wasn't pro or anti-vaccine. It was just that, you know, I sit on the board of the NFL Alumni Association, about 20,000 members in the organization. You know, there are some former nose tackles in the NFL that walk around 6'5", 6'6", 320, 330 pounds. And, you know, some of them are even bigger. They're ducking under doorways. And I have a 5-year-old niece that's 49 pounds. And you will never convince me that these two human beings get the same dosage of the same thing and have the exact same reaction. That was just my initial suspicion of how is this possible? They don't eat the same amount of food. They don't require the same nutrients. They don't consume the same calories. How is it that this one thing is magic? And I'm not formulating an opinion on that, but the point is that there are some individual needs that every human being has. And if you can find that deficiency and put that raw material back into the human body, there is a tendency for those people to thrive in ways they never thought possible. And, you know, I always talk about, I tell a story about when I was in grad school and I had to take all these plant botany courses. I was actually getting a human biology degree, but I had to study all these plants. I had to study morphology of thallophytes and green algae, and I hated it. But because I really wanted to, I love cadaver anatomy lab. I love anatomy physiology. But the one thing that struck me and always stands out is that if you have, for example, in plant biology, if you have a leaf rotting in a palm tree, and you call a true arborist, a true botanist out to your house, and they'll see that leaf rotting in the palm tree, but they won't touch the leaf. They will core test the soil. And they'll say, you know what, Tim, there's no nitrogen in the soil. And then they add nitrogen to the soil and the leaf heals. And for some reason, we've stopped thinking about human beings this way, right? We just lost all faith in humanity and mankind. We think we need to spray chemicals or synthetics on that leaf and trim it or cut it off. But the truth is that it was just deficient in nitrogen. When you gave it nitrogen, it healed. And you could have done anything to that soil that's really good for plants. And if you didn't find the nitrogen, wouldn't have mattered. Right? You could put sulfur, that's good for plants. You could put you could water the plant, that's great for plants. And you'd notice that you keep doing these things and the leaf never heals, but bang, you find the nitrogen and boom, the leaf heals. Human beings are no different, right? All of us process nutrients and minerals slightly differently. And if you test for that by doing a genetic methylation test, if you do and I say this all the time, you do not have to do the test through me. There are lots of great companies that do these tests. If you do a genetic methylation test and you see that my body has a problem methylating certain nutrients, which is going to lead to a deficiency, that deficiency is going to express itself as a pathology, as a disease, as a simple ailment that we think is a consequence of aging, brain fog, weight gain, water retention, poor sleep, poor focus and concentration. We're like, I'm just getting old. I'm just, you know, my kids are nuts. You know, my career is a freaking stress. No, it's actually none of those things. You are nutrient deficient. And when you find it and you put that raw material back, boom, they start to thrive. And they're like, oh my God, I feel amazing. And you really just feel normal. Your body has the raw material it needs to do its job.
It's an amazing machine, self-correcting machine, isn't
yeah.
it? And the right things.
And it's incredible how much punishment it can take and come back to normal.
So from your whole journey, coming from, you know, the data side of things and seeing what works and leading to this point, what are your favorite biohacks right now?
You know, this takes me back to the superhuman protocol, right? So the superhuman protocol is my favorite biohack. And I'll tell you how you can do it for $120,000. I'll tell you how you can do it for free. So people are like, let's just skip the $120,000 part and just jump to the free part. But, you know, we truly get three things from Mother Nature, right? We get magnetism from the earth. We get oxygen from the air. We get light from the sun. We are a lot more connected to the earth than you think. Earthing and grounding is a very real thing. Discharging into the earth, bare feet, touching bare soil, dirt, grass, sand is a very real thing. If it weren't free and somebody could patent it, we would give it the justification it deserves. And, you know, we were designed to spend 85% of our time outdoors. We spend 97% of our time indoors now. And we regulate our air temperature, we regulate our lighting. Most of us are spending a lot of time in the junk food of lighting, especially at night. So magnetism from the earth, you can get it two ways. You can pay for it by using a PEMF mat. You can get it for free by touching the surface of the earth. Oxygen from the air, obviously, you know, I read a statistic. I also got slaughtered by this, by my adversaries, because, and rightfully so, because I actually read an article that was written, and it was not a study, so there was no data to back it up. But what it said in the article was, at 30 or 35 years old, 90% of people will never sprint again. Now, in all transparency, there was not a study, so I don't know where the data came from. And I started to espouse that. I was like, whoa, that's crazy. And I put it on social media. I got my head chopped off. But somewhere in there lies the truth, right? The vast majority of people probably will never sprint again after the age of 30 or 35. And what does that mean? That means that our auxiliary muscles of respiration are just, they're atrophying, our intercostals, you know, the strength of our diaphragm, you know, the ability to pull oxygen down into the lobes of our lungs and keep it out of the apex of our lungs. So we're just not breathing really anymore. And so in the absence of doing that type of exercise, tapping into our auxiliary muscles of respiration through breath work and using oxygen from the air, which I would argue that the presence of oxygen is the absence of disease. And I think there's an enormous body of evidence to prove that the more poorly we utilize oxygen in the body, specifically the mitochondria, the faster we age, the faster all forms of disease and pathology. I mean, at the end of the day, I think a majority of these are mitochondrial diseases, mitochondrial metabolism diseases. And so my favorite biohacks are touching the surface of the earth or using a PMF mat. Breath work, which I do every day, regardless of whether I do the Hypermax oxygen or not. I'm a big fan of EWOT, exercise with oxygen therapy or multi-step oxygen therapy. And you can read Dr. Van Arden's work or Otto Warburg's work, still some of the most incredible research, and it's decades old, and light from the sun. And I think we've been taught to fear the sun. And I think the majority of us are not getting enough sun. It's not that we're getting too much sun. And if you're afraid of the sun, then expose your skin to sunlight during the first 45 minutes of the day when there's no UVA, when there's no UVB, when there's healthy blue light, not the blue light like we get from our screens, but healthy blue light. Reset your cortisol and melatonin receptors. Get yourself tied back into the circadian cycle of the sun. You know, we weren't really meant to have bright fluorescent lights late at night, right? Sending junk food into our brain late at night to stimulate a waking response that really shouldn't be there and then fight to go to sleep.
Well, it's interesting because it came up last night at dinner. I went to dinner with Dr. Patrick Porter and mm-hmm. Barton Scott, and it came up exactly about this, is in like sun exposure or natural light exposure in the morning prepares your body for the sun for the day, and it fills the receptors. So for instance, if you're getting that early light, your body says, oh, I've got to prepare today, and therefore gives you natural protection. Hmm. So it's actually really, really interesting how it's come up now twice in 2 days yeah. on pretty much exactly the same thing. And I'm a firm believer that, you know, you have to respect the sun, obviously, but you also have to respect the timing of your sun exposure mm-hmm. as well. And, you know, people say, oh, it's bad, you know, it's giving us skin cancer, this, that, the other. But the thing is, our ancestors made it to this point, but having natural exposure at the right time.
Skin cancer was significantly lower 50 years ago than it is today. And why is that? And we really we had natural sunscreens. We didn't have the kind of sunscreens we have now. And there's been 20 sunscreens since, 2003 pulled from the market because of their cancer-causing properties in the sunscreen. I think there's a growing body of evidence to show that seed oils and oxidation, especially in the surface of the skin, is what's actually causing the parabolic rise in skin cancer, and not the actual exposure of the sun. It's the exposure to the sun in the presence of all of these toxins that are causing, you know, free radical oxidation in the surface of the skin and cellular dysplasia, one of the big culprits being seed oils, right? And I'm talking about industrial processed seed oils, because people go, well, olive oil's been around for a long time, and so has, you know, different types of avocado oil and canola oil. Yes, but we used to press these oils, we used to cold expeller press these oils, and now we degum them with hexane and we deodorize them with sodium hydroxide and we heat them to temperatures that turn them rancid and denature them. And so we bastardize the seed oil and then we still call it a seed oil. Mm. And so again, it goes back to, you know, if you ask me my three favorite biohacks, it's magnetism, oxygen, and light. Either PMF, Hypermax, and a red light therapy bed, or touching the surface of the earth, breath work, and sun exposure. And, you know, if you said, well, what should we be eating? We should be eating whole foods.
But it's all energy. That's everything's energy, isn't it?
It so is.
Photons, sun, free electrons.
Dude, we are
nutrients and
very much photovoltaic beings. Yeah. You know that there are rays, there are wavelengths of light that come from the sun that will pass through your skin. They will dissociate a gas in your mitochondria called mitochondrial nitric oxide. And when they pass through the wall of the cell and it crosses the cytoplasm and it goes through the wall, the mitochondria enters the mitochondria. There's a binding site called cytochrome C oxidase, not to bore you to tears, but basically think of it like a one-armed man. So it can either shake hands with the gas nitric oxide or it can shake hands with the gas oxygen. If I wanted to let go of nitric oxide and grab oxygen, very often these wavelengths of light that are coming from the sun cause this to naturally occur. You can also get it in photobiomodulation in a red light therapy bed, which is a red light therapy bed, in my opinion, is the rage in anti-aging and, you know, longevity, recovery, bio-optimization, very little downside, lots of upside. So now you've essentially forced oxygen to dock. And, you know, oxygen, when it enters the Krebs cycle, when it enters the cycle of creating energy in the mitochondria, it takes us from 2 ATP to 38 ATP, net 36 ATP. So in other words, there's about a 16-fold step up in energy. So you can charge yourself with the sun, literally, you can charge yourself. And there is a scientific principle between that light hitting your skin, causing a chemical, positive chemical chain reaction, which increases the oxidative state of the cell, which gives the cell more energy to eliminate waste, repair, detoxify, regenerate, and you can tap into it every day for free.
It's really interesting because I once heard a quote by Dr. Jack Cruz, controversial guy, as we all know, and he said that DHA is the only lipid known to be create a DC current from sunlight. And so that was one thing that was in my mind as you were saying that. And the other thing is if we're having really rancid seed oils and our fatty acids are all off, and bearing in mind that
oxidized cholesterol sunlight, versus just cholesterol.
Yeah, so sunlight sulfates cholesterol into hormones, I believe that, if I'm correct in saying. So therefore, if we're having crappy oils and all our fatty acids or omegas are all out of whack, and we're having rancid oil and not enough sunlight, it's an electrical nightmare.
Yeah. You know, and what's, you know, I did not see, again, I'm not making a medical statement for or against statins, for example, but in my career, I did not see a single centenarian that did not have what we would consider clinically elevated levels of LDL cholesterol. And there's a war on cholesterol, you know, that all cholesterol is bad. And now we're on to Apolittle A, Apolittle B. There's a lot more to the cholesterol story than just LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol. But I, you know, very often when these death claims would be processed, you would see the blood work, because sometimes we were in hospice, sometimes they were in hospital. You'd have blood work on these folks. And in my 20 plus year career, I didn't see a single centenarian. Now, a lot of those claims were filed without having the blood work. So I'll put that caveat in there. And I certainly didn't see all of them that were filed, but I didn't see a single centenarian that didn't have clinically elevated levels of LDL cholesterol. In the majority of cases, they had normal to very low triglyceride, but they had slightly elevated levels of LDL cholesterol. So it makes me wonder if all of these centenarians had elevated levels of LDL cholesterol, if the war on cholesterol is really warranted. I don't want to put a dangerous message out there and people say, I'm not going to take my statin. Please don't do that. If your doctor has you on a statin, take a statin. And there's evidence to show that they help as well. But I think what's happening is the perversion of food and the absolute chemical assault that we're under is making compounds in the body that are otherwise helpful construction materials that we use to build cell walls and cell membranes and hormones, is making these villainous because we are chemically changing the impact that this compound has. It's not the compound itself. And so we're waging war in the wrong areas. We're going after natural fatty acids and lipids, cholesterol and things, when we really should be going after the chemical assault that's causing these to be caustic and not to be molecules for longevity, if that makes sense. And that's why I think, you know, helping people navigate this maze, hopefully the ultimate human is going to grow into a chemical-free living repository where you can learn to wash your clothes and clean your countertops and brush your teeth and wipe your butt with things that are not going to micro poison you.
Yeah. it's quite funny you say that. I did some content on toilet roll a few months
ago. Yeah, I've been down the rabbit hole of toilet paper lately too. I'm like, what? Formaldehyde, bleach?
And it's like, people are like, you're just fear-mongering. I was like, no, pick your poison. Just like, know that you can do better choices. Pick your poison. Yeah. If you want to use normal butt roll, like, just fine. But you should at least be aware of what you could be avoiding. And it's like, it's funny.
I'm not yet ready to tan my butthole, but I am ready to wipe it with something that doesn't poison me. So I saw that trend and I'm like, well, first of all, I'm in a condo. So my neighbors would probably frown on me going into the child's pose in the birthday suit. But
Yes. Carnivore Aurelius was famous for talking about that one left and right.
Hey man, just trying to live forever over here.
So something I'd really like to touch on with you is, because part of my journey for fixing a lot of my issues was methylation. And I remember when I first heard that word, and actually I was sitting in a traditional doctor's lab, and there was this little old lady, must have been 85, 90 years old. And I said, how you doing? She said, oh, I'm okay, dear. I've just found out something interesting. And I was like, what is this? She said that you could have your genes tested and it tells you how well you detox. I was like, really? And this was like many years ago. It's like, interesting. What's it called? She said, I don't know, dear. Anyway, that was it. And then a few weeks later, I heard
it's called the methyl detox profile.
So anyway, I looked into it and found what methylation was, and went down that rabbit hole. And it's obviously a very, very complicated area, but it's actually so fundamental in many, many of our health, everyone's health, actually, like production of energy and detoxification, plus many other things in its simplistic form. So my point is, I'd love to hear it from you as how you would actually explain methylation to the listeners.
Well, the complexity is in the simplicity. In other words, like we talked about before, very often, and again, I'm going to stress that I'm not a physician. I'm not licensed to practice medicine. So the people that are deserve to be out there touching patients. But what I can tell you from reviewing hordes of research and my own experience and my background in mortality is that sometimes you have a myriad of symptoms going on in someone's body, and they are treated very often in mainstream medicine like spokes in a wheel. They're treated as individual pathologies and ailments, and we rarely look for the place where all of these meet. Like, what is the connection? Like, could there be connection between congestive heart failure, peripheral neuropathy, and early onset dementia? Well, they are all related to circulation. Could there be a connection between brain fog, weight gain, poor gut function, anxiety, and irritable bowel syndrome, right? Or does one person have this myriad of things going wrong with them, right? Like the whole world just went to hell in a handbasket at the same time. And I would argue that very often, not all of the time, these seemingly dispartite and unrelated conditions, right? Like I have anxiety, but I also have really bad gut issues. I have ADD and ADHD and I'm wired all day, but then I can't sleep, right? Because my mind is awake at night. I have poor focus and concentration. I have trouble controlling my temper. Like, so there are all these things that are seemingly unrelated, but they all meet very often at a common place called methylation. And methylation is the process that the body goes through hundreds of billions of times a day in order to take one raw material, a vitamin, a mineral, a nutrient, an amino acid, and convert it into the usable form. And this conversion is very important because when we can't make certain conversions, we have a deficiency. And these deficiencies lead to the expression of a lot of these conditions. So for example, we know that a clinical deficiency in vitamin D3 was the second leading cause of morbidity in COVID, at least the last time that I looked. But it had a massive impact on COVID morbidity. So this is the deficiency in a nutrient that, number one, is easy to replace, and number two, we could get from the sun. When we know that now there's a correlation between elevated amino acids in the blood, like homocysteine and cardiovascular disease and hypertension. And again, I'm not saying that all hypertension is caused by homocysteine, nor am I saying all idiopathic hypertension is caused by homocysteine, or that you should stop taking your medication if you treat homocysteine. What I am saying is that we know that there is a correlation between people that cannot properly methylate homocysteine into an amino acid called methionine and their increased incidence of cardiovascular disease. So why would we not go back to studying nutrient deficiencies before we go to chemical synthetics and pharmaceuticals, or at least do this in conjunction with? And so methylation is this process where we will take one raw material like folate and we will convert it into methylfolate. And it's also called one carbon metabolism. And what is amazing about the chemistry in the human body is that just by taking a carbon with three hydrogens, right, which is a methyl group, and adding it to or breaking it off of a molecule, you dramatically change that molecule's actionable impact in the human body just by snapping off a carbon and three hydrogens. And I mean, if you look at fats, for example, the difference between monounsaturated and polyunsaturated, saturated fats is how those carbon chains are assembled, how many are actually available. So when you look at human health and optimization, it very often comes down to the molecular structure in the body that is driven by this one carbon metabolism, snapping this carbon, this group off, or adding it to. So if we understand that this process of methylation is responsible for production of neurotransmitters, for the downregulation of neurotransmitters, for converting one amino acid into another, for taking a vitamin and turning it into the active form, then this is a great place for us to start hunting for deficiency, because about 44% of the world's population has a gene mutation called MTHFR, affectionately called the mother. Yeah, and you have the C677T and the A1298C, which is both of the alleles. And this gene, you can have this gene and it can be absolutely crippling, or you can have this gene and have virtually no effect at all. It's very much diet and lifestyle and environmental driven. And it doesn't mean if you have MTHFR, you have these conditions. But the association of this one gene mutation to such a wide myriad of seemingly unrelated consequences in the body is astounding, right? And this gene mutation is associated with greater incidence of repeated miscarriages. It's associated with higher incidence of postpartum depression. It's associated with higher levels of anxiety and anxiousness. It's associated with severe gut motility issues, which leads people down the pathway of thinking, I have a food allergy, I have a food sensitivity, I have a gut microbiome issue. And a lot of people's journey into what's going wrong in their gut has them down the wrong pathway, because they're not looking at the motility of the gut. They're looking at the contents of the gut. And they go, well, your gut microbiome is fine. You're not allergic to dairy. You're not allergic to wheat, corn, soy, blueberries, bananas. So you're eating the things you should be eating. Your gut microflora is fine, but you still have these irritable bowel syndrome-like consequences. Well, very well could be methylation, because methylation determines the peristaltic activity, the pace of the gut. It's also involved in the production of acid in the stomach. And most people think they have acid reflux because their stomach's producing too much acid. But the truth is, it's usually because it's not producing enough, or the concentration isn't acidic enough, because these valves at the top of the stomach are responsive to acid balance. And if my stomach acid is too alkaline, but it's still acid, but it's towards the alkaline end of the spectrum. You know, very often these sphincter muscles, cardiac sphincter, which is at the end of the esophagus, top of the stomach, can relax and the acid can splash out. And then a person goes, gosh, I got acid burning the bottom of my stomach. I need to take Prilosec, or I need to take Nexium or Zantac, or I think some of those have even been pulled off the market, but I want to take a proton pump inhibitor and shut the acid down so it doesn't burn, when you really needed to decrease the acidity, meaning make it more acidic so that that valve would slam shut.
It's interesting because I once heard, I can't remember who it was, I think it was James De Nicolitiano, say that chloride or salt, lack of salt means lack of stomach acid, mm-hmm. hydrochloric acid. And so stress means increases your need for salt. And if you don't have enough salt, you don't have enough stomach acid, you don't have enough stomach acid, bacteria and viruses get into the digestive system more so than they should, and therefore cause lots of gut issues. So it's just really interesting. And then as you were saying that, and we're talking about methylation and how it ties together with digestion, something that worked very well for me for homocysteine was actually trimethylglycine.
Oh, trimethylglycine's amazing. And TMG.
And we know glycine or trimethylglycine and betaine, obviously.
Yes.
So this all ties in together so beautifully, and yet a lot of it comes down to salt, hydration, minerals, and deficiencies. Folic acid is used to fortify a lot of foods, like pasta, rice, and cereals. Why do you think using folic acid is problematic?
I think it's the worst thing that ever happened to the food supply, to be totally honest with you. Folic acid is an entirely man-made chemical, right? You can't find folic acid anywhere on the surface of the earth. It does not occur naturally in nature. We make it in a laboratory. Folate occurs naturally in nature. And I think the impetus was a good one to say we should add folic acid to all breads, all white rice, all white flour, all white pasta, all grains, all cereals of any kind are fortified or enriched, which is the code word for sprayed with folic acid. If you look at the incidence of a lot of ADD and ADHD, of a lot of gut-related issues, you will find, again, there is no study that directly links these, but you find that as we started to add folic acid to the food supply, you had an increase in several of these conditions. You'll never convince me that a chemical that we make in a laboratory is somehow essential to optimal health. What really prevents neural tube defects, which I think was the impetus for folic acid, is methylfolate. If we had a methylfolate to bread, cereals, pastas, rice, grains, I would have much less of a problem with it. But we add folic acid to fortified or enriched foods. And you know, you talk to people that live in the States and they'll go, man, it's weird. I go to Italy and I have a bowl of pasta. I feel fine. Man, I walk down the streets in France and I smash a French baguette and I don't blow up like a tick. And then as soon as I come back here, because of the folic acid and the seed oils, you know, it makes me depressed. It slows down my gut. I think one of the most beneficial things that you can do, and you should try this if you're a mom or a dad and you have kids, especially if you have kids with any kind of behavioral issues or impulse control disorders or learning, not learning disabilities, but trouble focusing, concentration, hyperactivity. You just strip folic acid out of their diet for a week.
It's funny because I heard that folic acid actually blocks the methylation cycle for some, for a portion of people. I'm not sure what that portion is, versus methylfolate, which opens it up and gets it moving.
Exactly, because methylfolate is the natural form. Your body is eventually going to convert, if it can, if you don't have the MTHFR gene mutation, the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase gene mutation, if you don't have that gene mutation, your body is going to turn it into methylfolate. So why don't we just follow what the body does, right? A lot of times when we try to overpower a natural physiologic mechanism, it's like all these studies came out that, well, you should actually do cold plunging before exercise, not exercise. And I was like, well, that just makes sense because, you know, if I'm exercising intensely and I've just torn a bunch of muscle, what is my body going to do? It's going to send blood flow to that region. It's going to send amino acids. It's going to pull creatinine out of that area. It's going to pull out inflammatory factors and send oxygen. So why would I want to shut that down? And then, you know, 5 years down the road, the science proves that. But I think we could learn a lot by studying human beings and human physiology and trying to mimic the human physiology and say, well, we use methylfolate in all of these transactions, so why don't we supplement with methylfolate? If you put cyanocobalamin into the body converts it to hydroxycobalamin. So why don't we just use hydroxycobalamin? That's clearly what the body prefers.
And yet our foods are fortified with the wrong form.
I know.
So tell us about your upcoming book, Becoming the Ultimate Human.
So Becoming the Ultimate Human is just about my journey and my wife's journey. And, you know, essentially that I went on this journey to become an ultimate human because I felt like in my previous career, I lacked a lot of authenticity. I really wasn't in service to humanity. I made lots of mistakes in my life. And I think that those mistakes were because I was aggressively in the pursuit of money and not in the pursuit of, I was in the pursuit of wealth, but not really in the pursuit of people's well-being. And so the book, Becoming the Ultimate Human, is about the journey to becoming a whole human. And for me, it was about getting out of a very inauthentic industry and a very inauthentic place in my life and getting into a place where I could be very authentic and getting into a place in my life where I feel like it had some meaning because I can make some impact. You know, the greatest thing in life is finding something that you would otherwise do for free and then somehow monetizing it. So I talk about that journey, but it's also about my journey from becoming an accurate predictor of death to a supporter of life. And what I learned by studying what makes people die early for 20 years and flip that script into how can I help people live healthier, happier, longer lives.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I'm looking forward to having a read.
Good.
So Gary, thank you so much for being on the podcast with me today.
Been a blast, man.
It's been awesome to record with you today. And
we're going to do some biohacking after this, dude. Sticking him in a cold plunge, red light bed, a Hockett machine. We're going to do it all. Yeah. Thanks, awesome. Thank you for having me, man. Appreciate it.
A massive thank you to my guest, Gary Brecker. Learn more about Gary at theultimatehuman.com and pre-order his new book, Becoming the Ultimate Human. You've been listening to the Health Optimization Podcast, and I'm Tim Gray. Comment and leave the video a thumbs up if you enjoyed it, and subscribe to my channel to see more. See you next time, and remember, let's spread the health. Thank you again to Theranordic for supporting this podcast. They're bringing forward new science and new solutions for your gut health.